Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a proposal at the state capitol aims to keep kids away from sexually explicit material by targeting librarians.
And a new housing development in Mesa aims to help baseball players.
But first, there's a lot of technology around the U.S.-Mexico border. But it turns out there's even more tech in that area than many people know about because it's out of sight. Jared McDonald-Evoy of the Arizona Mirror was part of a team that looked into this. He joins me now to talk about what they found. Jared, good morning.
Good morning.
So let's start off let's talk about where you went, because this was a little bit of a reporting trip for you and a colleague, right?
Yeah. So this was a collaboration between myself and Todd Miller at the Border Chronicle. Todd's done a lot of reporting on the past 20 years on the southern border, specifically a lot of reporting on surveillance technology. We ended up driving around areas like Gila Bend, Tucson, Nogales, the Cells area. We drove basically pretty much as much as we could of the Tohono O'odham reservation as well.
And one of the things that you write about was sort of the, I don't want to say the lengths that are gone to, but the way that some of this technology is hidden, is sort of placed in a way that people driving by wouldn't necessarily notice that it's there.
Yeah, one of the things that we found was that these automatic license plate readers are placed within traffic cones, is one of the main ways that they're kind of making their equipment a little bit more covert. They're placing them in orange traffic cones, or these other, they're moving them now into these larger yellow, those impact cushion kind of cones. Mm-hmm. And they're also putting them in other places as well, like behind street signs, or hidden in those trailers that usually you would see that have, you know, warning signs of construction up ahead.
So what do law enforcement agencies say they're doing with these? Like, why do they need them there?
So these specific devices, these automatic license plate readers, belong to Customs and Border Patrol and the Drug Enforcement Agency. Our administration, and they told me, Customs and Border Patrol told me that they use this to stop illicit trade, to disrupt drug trafficking and criminal networks, they told me that, you know, for national security reasons, they don't really talk a lot more else about it, and that's what they said that this technology is used for.
Okay, so they didn't want to talk too much about it, but it sounds as though you were able to talk to some folks who have sort of been impacted by this, and they were interested in talking about it. What did you hear from them?
Correct. So we ended up speaking to some people who live out in the Tohono O'odham Reservation, where we found that at the entry and exit points of the reservation, people are scanned by, you know, when they're entering the reservation, they're scanned by Customs and Border Patrol. When they're exiting the reservation, they tend to be scanned by DEA. And we found that people in this area they're aware of this technology, and they find that, you know, a lot of the times when they're driving, say, from off reservation into the area, that they may get stopped by Border Patrol, who say that, you know, you're driving in an odd way, or they may say, you know, that, you know, we saw you driving from this really far away area or into this one area, and we found that suspicious, or people are just getting, you know, stopped consistently a bunch of times and not really given a reason why.
Hmm. I also want to ask you about some of the technology that is visible, that, you know, people can see. And you describe some what I imagine are cameras or some kind of like sensing technology that when you guys like drove up or walked up close to it, you could see it following you. Is that right?
Yeah. So these are that was one of these. They're called integrated fixed towers. They're also called IFTs for short. They're kind of integral to what's called the digital or virtual wall. And they're these kind of tall towers that on the top have these really high powered cameras that can see for miles. A lot of them are on public land. And when myself and Todd and a person we were interviewing went out to go view one of these towers, We were walking towards it, and it pivoted towards us and looked at us as we were walking towards it. Now, these towers, they kind of dot areas along Nogales. They're a little closer to the border than I would say some of these more covert things we've been talking about, which we found one of those covert things more than 100 miles away from the border, one outside of Apache Junction. But these are closer to the border and stare usually directly at the border. Customs and Border Patrol denied a records request I made asking for the footage that was taken that day of myself and my fellow reporter.
Hmm. What is the rationale for, as you say, using some of this technology farther away from the border, you know, 100 miles or more away from the actual border?
Customs and Border Patrol, their jurisdiction is generally 100 miles from the border. That's what was established by the Supreme Court in the late 1940s as their jurisdiction. That perimeter kind of includes like Tucson, Wilcox, Sells. But when I reached out to CBP to ask them about this, you know, us finding two different covert ALPR devices outside of that 100-mile radius, 132 miles, 111 miles, they told us that, you know, while that 100-mile area is primarily where they operate within, that there are other laws that allow them to operate anywhere in the United States. That was pretty much the answer and that they gave us.
Okay. So, Jared, very quickly before I let you go, is there evidence to suggest that this kind of technology works at keeping bad stuff from happening?
Well, Border Patrol is pretty hush on how this is being, you know, used in investigations or being used at all. There's not a lot of insight into how this is being used to catch smugglers or in cases. They're pretty mum on how this is being used on their end. You know, we've seen a lot of talk lately on how ALPR devices are being used by local law enforcement in cases of things like Flock, which CBP and federal law enforcement are known to also be able to have access to. We also know that these devices do make mistakes. They misidentify license plates, they misidentify people, or the people behind accessing this data can also make mistakes. So it's not a perfect system. And it's also been prone to data compromises and hacking that have led to issues as well, such as there was a system used by CBP back in 2019 called Perceptix that was compromised that led to a lot of Arizona license plates and driver's license being leaked onto the dark web.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. That is Jared McDonald Evoy with the Arizona Mirror. Jared, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Librarians could end up in prison under a new GOP proposal being debated at the state capitol. The bill, introduced by Senator Jake Hoffman, would make it a Class 5 felony, punishable by up to 2.5 years in prison for librarians who refer or facilitate access to so-called sexually explicit materials to minors. It builds upon a 2022 law that bans school employees from sharing sexually explicit material, expanding it to public libraries, adding harsher penalties, and expanding the definition of what's quote-unquote sexually explicit. And according to Senator Hoffman, it's necessary. Here he is arguing for it in committee recently.
It's reprehensible that we have an entire political party in this country that is openly supporting the sexualization of kids. You know, my colleagues across the aisle, they talk about important literary value that should be provided to 17-year-olds, that should be provided to 12-year-olds and to 5-year-olds. Yes, 5-year-olds. There are books with sexually explicit materials targeting preschool and kindergartners.
Hoffman also read to the committee a scene from the controversial teen coming-of-age book All Boys Aren't Blue, highlighting the kind of material that's out there for kids to consume. He also argued the criminal penalties were necessary to ensure employees comply.
This is inappropriate material for children. Our criminal code prohibits it if it's provided to them by Circle K or by a liquor store or by a Walmart or a Target. But yet somehow Democrats have no problems with the overt sexualization of children at the hands of librarians and school teachers.
But Democrats in the state have said this goes way too far. Governor Katie Hobbs has vetoed similar legislation from Hoffman in the past, and we are less than a year away, though, from the next gubernatorial election. And at least one GOP hopeful, Congressman Andy Biggs, told the Arizona Republic he supports legislation like this. So how are librarians responding to this idea? For more on that, I sat down with Erin McFarlane, Advocacy Committee Chair for the Arizona Library Association. And we began with where we are now and how this law would change things.
There was a law that was passed in 2022 that defined sexually explicit material, and for school libraries and for schools in general, said that they're not able to refer students to sexually explicit material without confirmed consent from the parent. Mm-hmm. This is being applied differently in different school districts across the state. Some school districts recognize that this is a curriculum law and only are applying it to school libraries and curriculum that is assigned in the classroom.
Sure.
And requiring parents to sign a permission slip if there's material that's considered sexually explicit under the law. And some school districts are saying that doesn't apply to the school library as a whole. Other school districts say it has. Hmm. So in those school districts where they've determined that this is applied to the school library, librarians and library staff, school staff have had to go through and evaluate every piece of material in the library, read it to see if anything in that piece of material could be considered sexually explicit under the law. They then have to separate those books out and are only allowed to circulate those books to students if they have that permission slip from the parent. So okay. That's already happening
already
in
happening.
School libraries. Yeah.
And it sounds like a lot of work, actually.
Yeah, it is quite a lot of work.
Okay, but putting the onus on the parents there, but also on the schools, for sure, to mm-hmm. try to figure out what this means and what's sexually explicit and what's not. You mentioned this particular bill also expands that definition of what is considered sexually explicit. What else might be included in that?
So it includes any kind of description of sexual excitement, and the bill is very graphic in the description of what that might mean. Mm-hmm. And school libraries would not be able to refer students to that, but then this adds public libraries into the mix, which
right.
haven't been in the bill before.
And that's a much bigger pot, right, in terms of
yes.
who's accessing that material and how many people it would affect.
Exactly. So that's a much bigger pot, and that's a lot more material. I mean, public libraries offer a lot more material than school libraries do. So if you're thinking about in this bill, the way it talks about public libraries is refer a minor to sexually explicit material, or this is the quote that's dangerous, facilitate access to.
Hmm.
So that means, you know, if we have books on the shelves in public libraries and we allow anyone to come into the building and access those books because, you know, everyone has the First Amendment right to choose what they want to read, including minors, that's been, you know, said time and time again by the Supreme Court,
right.
just having those books on the shelf in the library could be considered in violation of this law because we're facilitating access to or allowing minors to access those materials.
And it would criminalize, punish potentially with jail time, the librarian.
Correct.
What's the reaction among librarians to that?
I think there is a feeling of disbelief and fear that this is something that could happen to them in their everyday job. And there's a lot of anger that, you know, librarians do a lot of hard work and they are essential to the communities that they serve. All libraries are local. They all work to serve their, you know, local communities. And librarians do a lot every day to ensure that kids have access to books. They can help to learn to read. They're constantly connecting folks to resources. So not only books and DVDs and audiobooks, but computers and hotspots and jobs and all different kinds of, you know, sometimes it's help with eviction advice, you know, as they're connecting folks to resources. So there's lots of different stuff that librarians already do and work hard to do. And then, you know, when legislation like this is proposed, they're looking at it and thinking, gosh, now I could become a felon simply because I'm doing my job. So there is that disbelief and a little bit of anger involved.
Bills like this have passed in other states in the country, not that many, but some.
Mm-hmm.
What has that looked like there? Like, are we looking at adults-only libraries in Arizona?
Yeah. So that is something that's happened. So, for example, in Idaho has a law very similar to this. And in Idaho, they do have an adults-only library now.
Hmm.
Because if you think about the facilitate access language and you have a very small library, one room maybe, very much like we have here in Arizona and some of our small and rural communities, it's very difficult to separate out books that are there for adults that might be considered sexually explicit under the law and not allow children to walk over to those shelves, you know, and pull off a book of any kind. So in fear of being in violation of this type of legislation, there are libraries in Idaho that have become adult only. And so, you know, those community members, children are allowed in the library, but only with a parent or guardian or with different types of permission slips, I think, that are signed and they have to go through a special process.
So there are some examples, I think, of sexually explicit material in books, especially some young adult books for teens that are pretty explicit, right? Like including some that the sponsor of this bill, Senator Jay Kaufman, read at committee about this from All Boys Aren't Blue, which has been, you know, at the top of subject to debate about this as well, I know. Where do you think the line should be? Like this can include things that certainly are very explicit in nature, but does it also include like Romeo and Juliet? Are we talking about scientific materials as well?
Yeah. So because of the vague description of sexually explicit in this law, it could include many things that people I don't think would consider something that shouldn't be in the hands of, especially a young adult or a teen individual in the state of Arizona, like Romeo and Juliet. There are passages in the Bible that would be in violation of this law. Mice and Men would be in violation of this law. To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, some American classics would be in violation of this law. And so when librarians are looking at this, we order books and have material available at the library to reflect the wide, diverse community that we serve. And we expect that individuals should be able to choose the books that they feel are relevant for themselves and relevant for their families. So, you know, there might be books that I choose and are okay for me and my children and my family that you might not choose. Mm-hmm. The example I always give is I had a daughter that, believe it or not, was afraid of aardvarks when she was young, terrified for some odd reason. And we did have to look through books at the library and say, okay, this is a picture book with an aardvark. We're not bringing it home for our family. And I give it to the person at the front desk and say, this one's not for us, and you can put it back on the shelf. But never did I say, this one's not for anybody because I want to spare the community from aardvarks. So please take it off the shelf entirely. And so I think that's, you know, the line is drawn at the family. You know, obviously there are obscenity laws in this country.
Right.
And so books on the shelf in the library do not meet the law of obscenity as defined by the Supreme Court.
There are already laws on the books about
exactly.
Obscenity. What about like when it applies to kids, though? Like you're saying it should just be in the hands of the parents to decide and the books are there for them regardless.
Yeah, the books are there for them, for the kids, and the parents should decide, you know, whether or not a book is okay for their family. And, you know, everyone develops at a different time and level. So what might be feel appropriate is a word that's used, but what might feel appropriate for, you know, your five-year-old might feel different from my five-year-old, depending on what we teach and what we have, our beliefs and values in our family. But the books on the shelf in the children's area, you know, in the young adult area were specifically written, you know, as relevant to that age group. And so if you think about scientific materials, health materials, those were written specifically to be relevant to, you know, kids going through puberty. There are puberty books that would be removed and that kids would not be able to access those.
Mm. Okay, we'll leave it there. Erin McFarlane, Advocacy Committee Chair for the Arizona Library Association, joining us to talk more about this bill. Erin, thank you for coming in. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the culture of care and the political forces that have brought so many Filipinos into nursing in the U.S. We'll hear from the creator of a new documentary profiling Filipino nurses here in Phoenix.
But first, more than 50,000 years ago, a meteor hit Earth and formed what we now call Meteor Crater in northern Arizona. But new research finds that impact may have had, well, impacts beyond that one site. A paper hypothesizes that event may have also triggered landslides in the Grand Canyon, more than 100 miles away. Those landslides may have led to a damming of the Colorado River, creating a lake. The evidence for this, at least in part, comes from driftwood from Stanton's Cave along the river inside the canyon. Chris Basin is a research specialist at the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research at the University of Arizona and has worked on this research. He joins me to talk more about it. And Chris, how surprising is what you found in the sense that one event triggered other events?
Well, I think it's pretty unusual to, you know, it wasn't what we were looking for. This was not a research question when the initial investigation started. It was just an attempt to verify the dating on some wood that we had in our archive, as it might have been related to something that work that Jonathan Palmer was doing down in New Zealand.
So you were just trying to figure out like how old this wood was, and it kind of led you to this other discovery?
Yeah, so Jonathan and some people down under there were investigating this magnetic pole reversal that occurred around 42, 43,000 years ago with tree rings and radiocarbon work. And the wood that this driftwood we had from Stanton's Cave had been previously dated to around 43,000 years. So we wanted to verify if it really was 43,000 years ago, and that, and therefore might bear on the research that Jonathan and his colleagues were already doing. When we got the date back, it turned out to be over 50,000 years old. So, you know, it didn't have anything to do with that period of time that we had initially been interested in. And Jonathan had, previous to a visit to Tucson, had stopped at the meteor crater and was aware of the proposed date for the impact there. And so when we got the date for the wood, he just kind of in an off-the-cuff way, the way that you might, if you're having a conversation at a bar or something, oh, isn't that interesting, you know, that the meteor struck about the same time as the date, the radiocarbon date we got for the wood. And the group of people that were involved with that radiocarbon dating and myself, you know, we just kind of kicked it around a little bit and said, well, it is kind of interesting. Maybe there's something there. Maybe we should look into it.
Well, so how did you go about trying to connect one to the other?
So the first was to investigate what the researchers who had looked at the driftwood in Stanton's Cave back in the 1970s and early 80s, see what they had said and what their reasoning was for why there was driftwood in this cave that's really high above the river. And, you know, their hypothesis was that downstream from the cave, a section of the canyon wall had collapsed and dammed the river and made a lake. And this had raised the water level near the cave high enough to allow in flood times for driftwood to be deposited in on the cave floor. So the fact that there was this rockfall, which is unusual. I mean, there are not many events like that that have occurred in the canyon that people are aware of. This rockfall is an unusual event. The meteor impact is an unusual event. And we began to speculate that they might be linked.
What is the significance of the fact that this one event triggered more impacts? I guess maybe impacts is not the right word, but more incidents on Earth.
Well, meteor strikes, of course, are a common occurrence in our solar system, but on Earth, there are not that many large ones that are recent. So a meteor crater is an example of one that's, in geologic terms, relatively recent. The crater's well-preserved, and it's possible to actually study it a little bit. So, you know, it's a nice opportunity to maybe try to see if, you know, we can demonstrate that these things are actually connected and that the rockfall might well have been a consequence of the impact.
Is it possible that there are more consequences, like more events happened as a result of the sort of the chain reaction here?
Well, I mean, there's been some work done estimating what impact did in the local area. Of course, it spread debris all over the place, a kind of a rain of fiery debris, and probably caused wildfires. There's a sediment core in a lake that's not too distant from the crater, where there's a charcoal layer that might be associated with some fires that were caused by the impact. And certainly the wildlife and, you know, things that were around the crater were highly impacted, but this is at some distance. It's over 100 miles away, so that's kind of interesting. And it serves as just a reminder of, you know, you have an event, you can see the crater, but then trying to understand what would happen, you know, if we were to observe such a thing today. That's an important line of investigation, I think.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought up the distance because, as you say, you know, the Grand Canyon is not right next door to Meteor Crater here. It's as you referenced, about 100 miles away. Is there a significance to the fact that the impact at Meteor Crater could have an impact that far away? Like, does that tell us anything maybe about the size of the impact or about the dynamics of the impact in some way, that it could affect events so far away from where it actually happened?
We're hoping that some follow-on work will try to model the seismic effect of the impact and look at the structural geology of the terrain between the crater and the canyon to see how effective that those rock layers might be to transmit the impact, and maybe provide a little more evidence that would support the hypothesis that we put forward.
So does that mean that it would be dependent on sort of what's below the surface to determine, it would help you figure out like why something that happened at Meteor Crater affected the Grand Canyon?
So the impact caused an earthquake, you know, what we would refer to as an earthquake. But as opposed to the typical seismic activity that we have when we think of, you know, the San Andreas Fault or something, those occur well below the surface, sometimes many kilometers below the surface. And this is a seismic shock that was delivered to the surface layers. So the upper layers would be the ones that would transmit this laterally over to the canyon. And that's the Colorado Plateau. There's sedimentary layers that stretch all across there. So it would be helpful to have a model that was specific to that region, and then a simulation of what we think the explosive force was and how that might be transmitted.
All right. That is Chris Basin, a tree ring scientist at the University of Arizona. Chris, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. D. Graham Burnett is a history professor at Princeton, and he thinks we're at a pivotal moment in history, a moment he likes to compare to the birth of environmental activism or the labor movement. We are, he says, facing a crisis of attention. Burnett is a co-founder of the Strother School of Radical Attention, a project of a nonprofit called the Friends of Attention. They advocate for a practice they call attensity, paying attention to attention. It's an urgent mission, they argue, because we live in a world where our attention is being ruthlessly exploited by tech companies who have figured out how to exploit it for profit. Burnett will give the annual Humanities Institute Distinguished Lecture tomorrow evening at ASU. As he tells our co-host Sam Dingman, it will be a call to action against, quote, human fracking.
Big tech operates as an extractive industry, extracting something essential from our personhood. You know, petroleum fracking involves pumping high-pressure, high-volume detergent down into the earth to get the oil and natural gas up to the surface. And there is a way in which, you know, the companies do sort of pump into our eyes and minds and faces high-pressure, high-volume detergent in the form of low-grade, slop kind of content,
right?
Rage bait, right? And playing on our fears and hungers. To be clear, we spend a lot of time doing things we like on our devices.
Yes.
And our movement is not anti-tech. The Friends of Attention actually like to focus on the problem being exploitation, not our quote-unquote phones. The problem is the underlying and heedless, unregulated, greedy business model,
right?
Human fracking.
So that's interesting, though, Graham, because you do in, you know, your language around this, and I realize by saying you, I'm referring to a collective movement, not you specifically. But the Friends of Attention do describe this as a crisis. And for you, what makes it a crisis? And I hear you that exploitation is part of that. But what do you see as the end game if people don't sign on to this mission that you're calling for of fighting back against the extraction of our attention?
To be clear, we are in favor of fighting back against the human frackers, but our movement is not merely a sort of negative or defiant thing. Attention activism basically involves doing the stuff that makes you feel closer to yourself and others in the world, rock climbing, throwing dinner parties, doing some community service, you know, music lessons for kids, sports. The issue is just that over the last 10 years, big tech has noticed that groups of people like doing things with their attention together, and the industry has expanded by identifying those activities. And then there's somebody with, you know, a deck leaving business school proposing to get all the people who like doing those activities using some app to do whatever it is they do, so that then one can frack the heck out of them. That's like the history of Pinterest. It's the history of Facebook. These are ways that people were already finding each other and liking certain forms of contact with each other, that in being moved onto these digital platforms have been subjected to this kind of fundamental tax. Our point is, this is not a you thing. This is not like a private shame thing where you're like, oh, I went down, you know, a rabbit hole. I was on TikTok for 3 hours when I wanted to just check one thing. This is not personal shame. What we need is a kind of collective solidarity. Like, we need to convert that private shame into something more like political anger.
What does that look like for you? I mean, is it legislation limiting the reach of what tech companies are able to do? What are your goals there?
Yeah, I think in 20 years, we will look back at this moment and we will say, oh, my heavens, how could people have let it get so bad? How could they have not understood the way that those large tech companies did not have the best interests of humans, like, at the core of their business models? Just like we look back now, you know, at the 1950s, and we're like, oh, how could people have not seen, you know, that the tobacco industry was harming people? Did you all really believe that the doctors who were telling you that, like, mentholated cigarettes were going to help you with your asthma? Did you really think that was true, you know? Right. And our analogy here, so I'm a historian by training, is a little bit like the Industrial Revolution, when new forms of technology made possible new forms of exploitation of labor, and that those new forms of exploitation actually created new possibilities for political resistance. So I'm talking about, for instance, the factory systems of the textile industry in the 19th century in England, and then the emergence of labor politics and unions and strikes as ways that workers who've been sort of reduced to their labor were able to sort of use that new position for a new kind of collective power. Uh-huh. And I don't pretend to understand the precise shape that this moment will take, but we are being reduced, or transformed, you might say, into sort of attentional subjects. And the question becomes, what forms of new collective political action will permit us to establish the worlds we want to live in, rather than having those dictated by tech barons and AI algorithms?
I'm curious if you see humanity anywhere in the world of tech, and how you see perhaps tech being friendly to this reconsideration of attention. What is being tech-friendly in your framing look like?
Well, I'm an academic and I did my PhD in the history and philosophy of science. So I love tech. I'm very interested in the history of science and technology. There's lots to say here. I did an essay for The New Yorker last year on AI, attention, and education. And in that piece, I make an argument about the way that AI, by taking over certain features of the sort of production of knowledge within universities, may actually reopen us to spaces of study and contemplation within educational spaces, because it becomes a matter of what do humans do that the machines cannot do. The machines have lots of answers, but they do not have questions, and the having of questions is our work. And I like the idea of the experience of study and reflection with others that centers on our sharing and holding questions together.
Well, D. Graham Burnett is one of the authors of Attensity, a manifesto of the attention liberation movement. He's also a professor of history at Princeton University, and he will be coming to ASU on February 26th to talk about all this and more. Graham, thank you for this conversation.
Such a pleasure. Thank you, Sam.
Spring training is underway here in the Valley, and one team is looking to build new housing near its stadium. The Chicago Cubs plan a new hotel and housing near their facility in Mesa on the site of a former county animal shelter. Brandon Brown, senior reporter at the Phoenix Business Journal, has written about this and joins me to talk more about it. And Brandon, what exactly is this project?
So they're building this new two-building facility next to the Cubs spring training facility in Mesa. One building is going to be a player housing building. The other one's going to be a hotel. And the player housing building is going to be for minor league players within the Cubs system. So when they come here for spring training or other times of the year, they have a place to stay.
How big of a problem is it for players coming here for, you know, let's say a month or 6 weeks or so for spring training to have to find a place to live?
There's so many teams that are here and they're bringing in so many players. They are always looking for places to stay. Sometimes it's, you know, Airbnb, sometimes it's hotels. Depending on how big, you know, depending on how many players they have, teams have a lot of different solutions. But having their own place will be a lot easier for the teams just to have, hey, this team's staying here these days.
Do we know how many units there will be and like what they will look like in terms of amenities?
Yeah, so it'll be 36 units, but each unit will have 2 to 3 bedrooms in it. And it's, you know, kind of assumed that, you know, there might be multiple players staying in there at a time. In the documents filed with the city, they said that no one's going to be staying there for long amounts of time. But it's not necessarily a hotel either. So it's a residential building. They're asking for it to be a residential building, but it will be, you know, have 36 units with 2 or 3 bedroom units. And within there, there's going to be like a sports court facility outside, you know, because baseball players, you know, they're going to want to, well, even though they'll be practicing next door, they will also, you know, they're competitive guys.
Yeah.
They're probably going to want to play basketball or something afterwards against teammates. And then there's going to be, you know, some offices and stuff as well. And then next door, the hotel will be a pool and other stuff. And the hotel will be for the general public, but also in the documents filed with the city, the team and the developer said they want to they will be using it for team travel every once in a while as well.
So players that are maybe coming into town like on a rehab assignment if they're injured or, you know, team officials coming in might be staying at the hotel as opposed to in the residences?
Exactly. What some people don't realize is that these spring training facilities are actually used all year long by the players. Teams use them for developing players, for rehabbing players. So having a hotel right there next to it will just be a lot easier to be like, hey, we're staying at the Candlelight Inn and or Candlelight Suites. And then they're able to go to the facility right next door, you know, walk or take a golf cart or something.
So what happens to the residential units when it's not spring training time?
Most likely they'll be sitting empty or there's a chance, you know, like other players will be coming for other reasons and stuff. The way the developers wrote about it, they expect there to be people there, some people there year-round.
Okay. And as you write, this is not something that's unique to the Cubs or to Mesa. This is something that other teams around the Valley have done also near their spring training sites?
Yeah, the company who's doing this, Boyd Development Co., they're based up in Scottsdale, and they built similar things in Surprise for the Kansas City Royals and for both teams out in Goodyear for the Cincinnati Reds and the Cleveland Guardians. They built similar facilities for none of those had a hotel connected to them, but similar player housing situations.
Housing, especially for minor league players, has been such a point of contention in baseball over the last number of years. Is this seen as a way to try to help that somewhat? I mean, you mentioned that, you know, nobody's staying there for a super long period of time, although the developers believe there will be, you know, players or people in the residences year-round. Is this a way to try to alleviate at least a cost for, you know, if you're sort of a fringe major leaguer or a minor leaguer who doesn't make a lot of money, to be able to stay in a team-owned unit as opposed to having to, you know, buy your way into a hotel or rent an Airbnb or something?
Yeah, with the team having its own place to stay, they don't have to give out per diems or worry about, you know, are players able to pay or afford, you know, finding a place to stay. When the player knows, hey, I got to go to Mesa, and they have a place for me to stay, even if I'm sharing a player housing unit with a teammate, which is something they're used to already, you know, traveling and stuff. It just takes a lot of stress off of them, and it will save, you know, both sides, the players and the team ownership, money.
It also probably makes sense, like, you know, you don't need a car necessarily, right? Or you don't have to pay for an Uber to get somewhere if where you're living is within walking distance of the stadium and all the practice fields.
Like we're seeing in developments all over the valley, the idea that you could live, work, and play all within the same place, I think, is happening here with Major League Baseball as well.
Do you expect this, or do folks in this space expect this to continue to grow and more teams to be doing this?
Yeah, I think a lot of teams will be looking at similar situations. Some of the places around town where there's spring training is at, it might be harder. You know, when I think of Old Town Scottsdale or in Tempe where the Angels are, it might be a little bit more difficult to find, you know, where can I build houses for players. But I think a lot of teams have looked at this already, and we'll probably see more developments like this in the future.
Do we have a sense of what the timeline is for the Cubs and the developer to get this project up?
So right now the development's just going through the early stages of the development review board in the city of Mesa. So this still will have quite a ways to go. But once they get through the permits and the city's permission and everything, you get stuff in the ground, it'll be coming up here. It'll be, you know, in less than a year probably.
So potentially ready for next year's spring training maybe?
Possibly next year, if not the year after for sure.
All right. That is Brandon Brown, senior reporter with the Phoenix Business Journal. Brandon, thanks as always. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Filipinos make up about 1% of the American population, but 4% of America's nursing workforce. And during the pandemic, Filipinos accounted for 30% of COVID-related deaths among nurses. It's a stat that got our next guest thinking and inspired her to make a new documentary about Filipino nurses here in Phoenix. Gail Tamimbong is a filmmaker and interdisciplinary media artist, and she got a City of Phoenix Artist to Work grant to make the film called Duty Free Care. In it, she profiles two local Filipino nurses, one young and one older, Hannah and Kay. And she explores the cultural forces that draw so many of them into the field. I spoke with her more about it.
Hannah is my aunt. I would say that she was like the closest nurse in proximity to me. She studied nursing in the Philippines and then eventually immigrated here like so many nurses. And yeah, she spent some time in New York and then settled down here in Arizona.
And she has worked in and works in some really high stress, I think it sounds like, settings in nursing. Like, she worked in correctional nursing in the jails during the COVID pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. She talked about that. She works with behavioral health care, like involuntarily committed patients now. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about some of the things she talked to you about during this interview with her, which were pretty intense.
Yeah, so like we mentioned, she was a correctional nurse during the pandemic. The conditions in a place like a jail weren't exactly things that like people were focusing on too much during the beginning of the pandemic. So she kind of went into how like, yeah, like sometimes the inmates would be like a little bit like aggressive. Other times, like, you know, it was a matter of like they're in these cramped spaces. But currently she works in behavioral health. And again, like she's dealing with involuntary patients as like a nurse in those settings. Like, you're the closest person. You're like closest in proximity to these patients that like don't want to be there.
Yeah.
So like, unfortunately, you become like a target of like their frustrations, and like it's not even the patient's fault necessarily. It's because of like the system in which the both of them are in.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about that pipeline from nursing school in the Philippines to becoming a nurse in the U.S. This has existed for a long time, it sounds like.
Yeah. So America established a lot of Western nursing schools in the Philippines to fill in like healthcare gaps that existed because of like different war times and like because of the Filipino government wanting like an influx of American dollars to help bolster like the Philippine economy. There was this exchange of, okay, like, essentially, like, the Philippines is going to export a lot of nurses, and, like, it's going to be known mm-hmm. that, like, its biggest export is nurses. And there's so many recruitment agencies that kind of facilitate that. And, like, unfortunately, that also comes with, like, a lot of dicey practices, I would say.
Hmm.
These recruitment agencies will place nurses in workplace, like Filipino nurses in workplaces that Western nurses wouldn't necessarily be attracted to or like gravitate towards.
So tell us about Kay, this younger woman who is a nurse. One of the things I thought that was really interesting about her interview was she talked about her family's role in her decision to become a nurse and how it was almost expected, but she didn't seem to mind it.
Yeah, so I liked her perspective a lot on it because I think a lot of the time it can be very black and white where it's like, no, I don't want to be a nurse. Like, I want to be my own person. Or like, I do want to be a nurse because like I respect my family. But for her, it was very much like, yeah, I'm interested in these things anyways. Like, I might as well.
Hmm.
And, you know, she had that family support of like both of her parents being nurses.
I was interested also in her perspective on some of the incidents that have happened with patients where, I mean, it wasn't clear that she would label them as racist, but that other people kind of said that to her. And she thought, you know, this does happen a lot.
Yeah. Like she talked about how she had a patient who couldn't speak too much for themselves. So they had a family member that would be in and out. And essentially, like, the family member was accusing Kay and like some of her other coworkers of like not treating her brother very correctly. The nurses noticed a pattern that she would only speak to the Asian nurses like that.
Hmm.
I think this is like a prime example of like a microaggression that happens in the workplace. It's very easy to say like, oh, like they didn't mean it like that. Like there's a lot of plausible deniability there. But if it's something that you've experienced, like it's really easy to tell.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about Hannah a little bit more. And one of the things that really struck me about your interview with her was where she talks about the rewarding aspects of it. Mm-hmm. And this is the woman who works, you know, in behavioral healthcare and with patients who are being held involuntarily. This is hard. And it was amazing because she would say, like, you know, just a little smile from somebody and she would feel like completely gratified in her work, which seems like I would need a lot more.
Right.
Talk a little bit about her perspective on the work and just how hard it is.
Hannah talks a lot about Filipinos having this culture of care. I would also agree that like a lot of Filipinos are very family-based and being family-centered like that like comes with a level of everyday care. Yeah, I think that she finds it really rewarding because she's able to like juxtapose it with like the journey getting there.
Yeah.
You know, like studying in the Philippines and like her whole journey being centered around like, yeah, like I want to be with my family and I want to be able to do it in the States.
Mm-hmm.
I find that a lot of older Filipinos that are able to immigrate like that have that sort of narrative as well.
Yeah. Let me ask you lastly, Gail, just about the way you shot this, because mm-hmm. it's very tightly focused on just these two people and their faces. And you have like sit down interviews, but so much of it is just them kind of being themselves and their homes. It felt to me like it was shot very lovingly, I guess, is the best way I can put it. Tell me about your approach to that.
My cinematographer is Ellery Fakus. She's a close friend from film school. When I presented the project to her, I was like, I don't want to shoot at a hospital. Like, I know this whole project is around nurses.
Right.
But in my proposal for the grant, I really emphasized like, hey, like these nurses, like they're people. They're people outside of the profession,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there's an aspect of like, well, a lot of Filipinos I've noticed like their work is their life. But like, what do you do when you come home?
Mm-hmm.
Like, who are you outside of that? So mm-hmm. all that to say, like, I had worked with Allery in order to like shoot this the way that we did because I was like, I wanted to emphasize that these nurses are people. And like, when you're in a hospital and you see a nurse, like maybe sometimes like you're not registering that like that's a person too.
Yeah. All right. Well, you hit it beautifully. That is filmmaker and interdisciplinary media artist Gail Tamimbong joining us to talk about her film. Gail, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks for inviting me.
And that'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. Thanks, as always, for being along. Remember to sign up for the show's weekly newsletter, Radio Heads. You can do that at theshow.kjzz.org. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at KJZZ The Show.